Hello and welcome to Dialect from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM, that's 103.2 FM up there in Preston, and Radio Volum in St Albans. I'm Sophia Costa.
And I'm John Peters Coleman. That was the voice of Ernest Lough singing Over the Wings of a Dove from Mendelssohn's anthem Hear My Prayer. That recording, made in 1927, was HMV's biggest selling record and was to make the anthem, the choir and the soloist world famous. Graham Lough, son of Ernest Lough, lives in Bristol and is here in the studio today to talk about his famous father. Later on in the show we also have Tony Gosling with a feature on a tour of Kingswood Museum's garden and grotto. Coming up later in the show...
He was taken out at night and shot and buried under some trees where he still is.
We also have part two of Guernica. Palmyra Sullivan talks about Picasso's painting and the atrocities in Spain during the Spanish Civil War.
Malcolm Greaves reads part two of chapter 8 from Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Tim Burrows is in the studio with a song and Rosemary Dunn is going to read one of her poems.
Ah, it's a pleasure to introduce our first guest, Mr. Graham Lough. Hello.
Hello.
So tell me a little bit about how well you knew your father, the famous Ernest Lough.
Well, I sang in the Temple Church Choir where he had made the famous recording. When his voice broke, he joined the choir as a baritone. And when the choir was reformed in the 1950s, because the church had been bombed during the war, the choir was reformed in the early 50s, and my father was in the choir when it was reformed, as my elder brother was.
Is that how you, through church and singing as a child, you became aware of his fame as a singer?
Well, yes. I mean, it was known when you were a kid that there was a famous recording. Obviously, in those days, in the 1960s, it was much more well-known than it is now, though it's still well-known, of course. Yeah. But there would be people at school that I was with that knew about it. And singing at the Temple Church, it was such a famous recording in its time. Yeah. When you sang in the choir, you just knew that that recording had made the choir very, very famous.
I mean, the cult of celebrity and fame sort of has a different tint on it now. But, I mean, did that have much of an impact on your everyday life, particularly as a kid?
Not for me. I mean, interestingly, when my father made the record, it was assumed that he, you know, became a sort of big media star. Well, of course, in those days in the 1920s, the media wasn't what it is now.
Yeah.
And though he sang the solo in the choir, he was just one of the soloists that sang in that choir. He didn't get paid vast amounts of money because the choir, which was quite a large choir, all got paid the same.
I'm guessing anybody sort of under 40 who probably might be drawing a few blanks and thinking, oh, well, I've heard of this tune. I know, I recognise the name and the tune, but what is it? I mean, tell us a little bit about why this tune is so well known.
Well, it came at a very interesting time in the recording industry, because in the 1920s, there were recording studios and records were being made, but they were all made in the studio. And then in the sort of middle 1920s, about 1926, HMV, which was the main recording company in the country at the time, devised a recording van that meant that it could go away from the studio and record on location.
Fantastic.
And that's when the organist at the church at the time, George Thorburn Ball, knew this and thought, well, this would be a good opportunity for the recording van to go to the Temple Church and record something at the church.
Okay, here in Bristol?
No, this was in the Temple Church in Fleet Street in London.
Okay.
And so the recording van went to the church in London to make this recording.
Right.
Really, not really knowing whether it was going to be successful or not. The interesting thing, too, about recording in those days was that it wasn't done on tape, whereas, you know, as soon as tape technology came in, you could play something and hear it back and see whether it was good or not.
Yeah.
In those days, you recorded on wax masters. So somewhere outside in the recording van, there would be a large machine with a wax master, and you would just record
so
straight
sort of
onto a wax.
To have to take half the factory to the location.
Well, yes, it was a lot. You know, in those days, the equipment was very, very large. And the thing about it was that once you started recording, you couldn't stop. So if you started a recording and there was some chimes going off and a clock or someone was whistling or something, then that was no good. But when you did do what you thought was a good recording, you couldn't hear it back. It wasn't like, well, let's go and hear what that sounds like, because modern recording has done, you know, for years and years. In those days, you thought, well, I think that one was a good one, so let's say that one, let's run with that one.
Exciting time to be able to sort of be alive during the recording music, because I mean Elgar was still alive at that point.
Yes, he was.
And was recorded, you know, with him conducting orchestras, you know, with a very young sort of Yehudi Menuhin and violin,
yes,
and sort of things like this.
The interesting thing about my father's recording, he had a particularly pure voice, though he always maintained that he wasn't the only one in the choir that had a good voice at that time. But it was just thought that when they were making the recording, my father's voice was in the best shape.
Okay.
But he had a particularly pure sound. Now, of course,
how old was he at the time?
He was 13, which was quite old, actually, for a boy treble. But in those days, children were actually smaller than they are now. But he carried on singing until he was 16, whereas now, by the time you're 12, generally, your voice is breaking. Mm. Though my father always maintained that by being that much older, you had a bit more maturity in how to use your voice, whereas, you know, if you're only 9 or 10 and recording something, though you might have a nice voice, you haven't got that maturity to know how to use it properly.
Okay. So it's a sort of like an Alec Jones for the 1920s.
Well, yes, it's often thought, well, was he a sort of Alec Jones? But of course, when Alec Jones became famous, there was television, there was newspapers and all the rest of it. So it became much more a media thing. Whereas in my father's day, the record came out. And though it became very, very popular, that fame didn't affect my father particularly, right, other than that the congregations at the church suddenly got very much larger because everyone wanted to come and hear this, you know, very famous voice.
So what sort of social background did he come from?
He came from a fairly middle-class family in North London.
Okay. Were they sort of financially affected by the impact of this record?
No, not really. No. I mean, and interestingly, they thought that my father had quite a good voice. So his uncle sang in a cathedral choir in Southwark Cathedral Choir, and wanted him to join that choir. And he auditioned for that choir and didn't get in.
Ah.
So he then auditioned for the Temple Church Choir and they did accept him.
Okay. So how many recordings did he make after that one? How long did he last before his voice broke?
Well, that recording actually was made twice, because in those days when they made the records, they made it from the wax master.
Okay.
And they made so many records that the wax master wore out. So after about 6 months, they said, we've got to make another recording of this.
Right.
So there are, in fact, two separate recordings, which if you're very clever, you can hear there is a slight difference between the two, because my father was 6 months, 9 months older when he made the second recording. And then HMV suddenly thought, oh, we're onto a winner here. We'll just record him doing all sorts of things.
Okay. So let's talk about why is this famous. A lot of people say, well, this is the first record to, you know, sort of sell a million copies or get a gold disc. Is that the case?
When the record was first issued, they weren't counting how many discs were sold. They didn't start doing that until the early 1930s, by which time it had become very, very famous. HMV always thought that it probably sold about 5 or 6 million, but they were never certain. The recording was awarded a golden disc, but not until the 1960s, because I think HMV had realised that it had quite clearly sold a million discs, but they couldn't prove it. So instead of awarding a golden disc for a million record sales, which is what every golden disc is awarded for, it was awarded for 35 years association with his master's voice, because my father had carried on recording, you know, right through his career. So the golden disc says in commemoration of 35 years association with HMV.
Right, okay.
But people still say, oh, it was the first record to get a golden disc. No, it wasn't actually. That wasn't awarded until the 1960s.
So were there some wilderness years while his body went through puberty and his voice broke?
Well, it was always a question of, well, you know, what happens to a boy treble when his voice breaks? HMV, you know, very much wanted him to carry on recording, but in fact there's quite a period between when your voice breaks and you become a tenor or a baritone for that voice to settle down and actually be a really good voice.
Yeah.
And there's no guarantee, and Alec Jones is a clear example of this, that if you've got a very fine treble voice, you won't necessarily have a very fine tenor or baritone voice.
No.
My father did have a good baritone voice, but not an operatic voice, and not a very powerful voice so that he could sing in oratorios and things like that. I think HMV would have liked him to have carried on singing just on the back of the name. But in fact, the war came, and he was in the fire service during the war, and then after the war, he joined the Temple Church Choir as a baritone, and then sang as a baritone until he was in his sort of late 60s.
So, I mean, when you were a child growing up, did you feel sort of obliged to have a sort of passion for music as such?
Well, you weren't obliged. It was just in the family. And you know, music was very much part of our family. And because we all sang, you know, my brother and myself sang in the Temple Church Choir with my father every Sunday.
Yeah.
It was sort of normal. The interesting thing was that George Thorburn Ball, who was the organist when my father recorded, was still the organist when I was singing in the choir. Obviously, he was much older then. But Wisely never got either my brother or myself to sing any of the solos that my father had done, so that we were never compared to say, you know, well, it's not as good as how his father was, which would inevitably would have happened. And in fact, the Hear My Prayer for the Wings of a Dove is quite a difficult piece to sing. It's quite long for a treble to sing, but neither my brother or myself ever sang that in the Temple Church. I sang it with the school choir in the St. Bride's Fleet Street, which was just down the road. And interestingly, my father didn't come to hear it. I think he didn't really want to see how I compared.
Okay. When the sort of the 60s and 70s came around, you know, you'd have been a young man in those era. I mean, were you particularly interested in classical music in your 20s and 30s yourself?
Well, living in London and having an interest in music because I was singing, you know, music every Sunday, yes, you went to concerts, you went to all sorts of things. It was a wonderful time to be in London. I've got concert programmes of things that I used to go to in the 60s and early 70s, and you think, God, was I there hearing...
What do you think of classical music now? I mean, there's a certain sexing up of classical music, you know, G4, medieval babes, stuff like that. I mean, do you...
I'm not a great fan of crossovers, so I'm not watching things like opera star to pop star or the other way around.
Right.
But there's still some great music making going on, certainly here in Bristol. You know, we've got one of the finest chamber music venues in the world in St George's.
Yeah.
We should be thankful that, you know, those things, that places are still going strong and still producing some wonderful music.
Well, thank you very much for coming in. And now let's hear the whole piece. Would you care to introduce your father's voice?
Well, yes. Made in 1927, we'll hear the second part of the anthem, which is Over the Wings of a Dove, which is the part of the anthem which most people remember most, I think.
Okay, and what is the whole piece called?
The whole piece is called Hear My Prayer.
Right.
The second half is called Over the Wings of a Dove, and that's the piece we'll hear now.
Just outside the Ring Road, on the eastern fringes of Bristol, is one of the city's best-kept secrets. William Chapman was forced to leave Bristol for Kingswood because of the noise and pollution made by his works, which were at the cutting edge of the Industrial Revolution. Run by volunteers and open every Tuesday and Sunday, Kingswood Heritage Museum costs £2 to get in, as it gets virtually no support from the government, despite safeguarding some of the region's most important history. Alan Britton is one of the founder members of Kingswood Heritage Museum Trust, and he took Dialect's Tony Gosling on a tour of the grounds of Warmley House and William Chapman's famous zinc foundry, the first of its kind, which housed the world's biggest steam engine, the home to an impressive 18th century grotto complex.
My name is Alan Britton. I'm a member of Kingswood Heritage Museum Trust, in fact, a founder member, and we are in the garden of William Champion, who lived here from the mid-1740s until the late 1760s. 1769, the business was sold off. And his house is here, and 13 acres of garden, and also there's a similar area of what was lake, now a mobile home site. There are bits and pieces which are well preserved. Unfortunately, a lot of it's been sold off over the years, but some of the features are still here.
Now, the most obvious thing is this giant mound in the middle. What's that?
Exactly. You have to remember that these gardens were seen as a paradise, a private paradise, garden paradise. And so this would be their miniature world, a perfect world for them. For the family and for friends and relations, I doubt whether it was for employees, but they may have let them in occasionally. But you have to remember this was fairly late in the development of the Quaker movement, and so they were becoming more wealthy gentlemen than they were earlier. In front of us is this mound, and so this is a feature. These first occurred in Elizabethan times, and basically it's a miniature mountain. There would have been a path you could see winding round it, so the ladies in their nice dresses would be able to walk up to the top of it. There may have been a gazebo on the top, but also it meant that looking to the south, they could see the works, of which they were very, very proud. This is really cutting-edge technology and development. And then looking north was the rest of the garden. And from there, they could see their lake and see right up to the statue of Neptune and right on to the what we now call the summer house.
Just peeping around the side of the mound there, there's a sort of little footpath over towards the original champion's house. Right. And it actually looks to me like almost like the countryside, even though we're in the middle of Warmley here.
That's right. This is a park, what has now become a public park, preserved by what is now South Gloucestershire Council. And so this is open to the public. The bit immediately around the house is private. But yes, this is a park which, more by luck than judgment, has survived. Right, I'll take you around to the grotto. We have a fantastic grotto on this side, which will surprise you. We'll see when you go in, if you've never been in it, see what you think. Ladies and gentlemen of the time, educated people, as the Quakers were into Greek and Roman myths. They were fascinated by them. And so this garden, like many other gardens in the country, reflect this. And going back to this mound, if you read the story of Aeneas, who was one of the founders of Rome, by Virgil, written about the time of the birth of Christ, somewhere around about that, Aeneas, his father dies and his wife commit suicide just to spite him, and they go down into the underworld. He goes down to find them, but in the end of the story he wishes to become a god, and so he has to meet Zeus, the great god of the Greeks. The great god of the Greeks lives on a mountaintop in a grove of oak trees. He has to fight his way up against warrior priests, and here we have our miniature mountain with a grove of oak trees on the top.
And the grotto, I suppose, that's the underworld,
it's
is it?
The underworld, exactly. That's it, exactly.
Well, you see, you got me a bit nervous now about what was going to be down in the underworld.
Well, we just hope that there aren't dogs on the right set of keys.
Yeah, it's quite higgledy-piggledy, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
It's one of Bristol's best-kept secrets.
Well, it is, in fact, in the book Underground Bristol, and there's been a broadcast about it and so on, but still... still, people don't really know. There we are. Right, follow me in. What do you think?
That looks a little bit dangerous, like a sort of pit there that you could easily walk into and fall down. I don't know how far down does that go?
Oh, it goes down about 7 feet. What we are in is this grotto. It's an artificial cave. Again, similar to the garden, they were all the rage in 17th and 18th century. Basically, the design came from Italy, and they go right back to Roman times. There are many of them initially, quite a few. There's even one in Bristol at Goldney. This is quite a large grotto, and it's built of slag from the factories which were here, and also stone. And it's made to look rough, like an artificial cave. And here we have a pair of rooms. This room matches that room. But in here is a plunge bath with a ledge round it. And there's a water inlet at the far end. on this site was a huge steam engine which pumped water around the works because there was not enough water in the brook, so they pumped it back to run over the water wheels. And the engines were only about 1% efficient. So lots of the heat, probably 90% of it, went into the water. And here we have water coming from the engine, so this would be warm water to bathe in. And so,
well, so it's a heated swimming pool, really.
Yes. Oh, yes, yes, a heated pool. And this is just one of several pools in here.
So what's the idea of having it underground, though?
It's just a fashion which, in Italy, as you can imagine, the summer it's very hot. And so it's a cool place to retire to and contemplate and stroll about. And these were copied over to Britain. And it was thought originally that they wouldn't work because of our cold and weather. But in fact, they did. People became very interested in them. And although it's cold here, they liked them. And they are very mysterious. School children love it. They come in with their torches and run around.
And now you've also got a shaft of light coming down from the ceiling there.
Yes, well, this is, adds to the mystery, just limited amount of light. But it would, in fact, have been more open. These archways would have been more open here. And this was for the family to enjoy. They would have had parties in here. You can imagine all these Quakers having parties with flaming torches in the wall and so on. Yes, and right up until early 20th century, parties were held in the gardens down here. We have a blind passage going off to the left, and we're not quite sure what that was for, but there's also a blocked-up doorway here, as you can see. Now, what was that for? We don't know. It might have been an earlier building on the site. We don't know, because things have been altered time and time again. If you come over here, you can see how this has been altered. There's not only a half an archway there, you see?
Yes, that's right. It looks as if this section here on the right, the dividing wall between here and the plunge bath, has actually been added to this at some point.
Afterwards, I think they were always altering it, yes.
And actually, looking just outside, it looks like there's another place to go bathing at the outside. I suppose this is more for the summer.
There are two more pools here. One just on our left under the big opening, which wouldn't have been at the time. There would have been a small opening. And on the right here, this is very Gothic, which was the fashion of the time. And here we have another pool and a waterfall or a cascade coming down from the top. And that would have been connected through to this water pump, which I was mentioning. And it would pump a huge amount of water, you know, perhaps 500,000 gallons a day, something like that it was capable of doing. You had the largest steam engine in the world here in the 1760s.
That was founder member of Kingswood Heritage Museum Trust, Alan Britton, talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling. And we go deeper into the grottos next week. The museum is open every Tuesday and Sunday through the summer and autumn. You'll find it in Warmley on Tower Lane. In fact, it is William Chapman's historic tower that gives the lane its name. And they are currently looking for volunteers. And just to remind you, it's open Tuesday and Sunday from 9:30 to 4:30 p.m. We're now going to hear part two of Guernica with Palmyra Sullivan. This week, Palmyra talks about Picasso's famous painting, Guernica.
Has the painting of Guernica come to mean for the Spanish people since?
I think not only for the Spanish people, the Guernica painting. The painting came to England during the Civil War. It was painted for the Paris exhibition. It was the Spanish entry for the Paris exhibition. And then it came to London and it was exhibited in Whitechapel, I think it was. And the entry fee for the exhibition was a pair of boots for a Republican soldier. The Spanish public were very aware of it, but I think it has become a sort of universal symbol of the horrors of war, really. You can see, if you look at the painting, you can see the bull and the person there who's in great distress, and the horse in the middle that represents the people, and the light. I suppose you must have hope in some way. But it really is not just about the Spanish Civil War, it's about war in general.
It's painted in black and white. Why was that?
To make it more dramatic. What it represents is so shocking that if it had been in full colour, I think it would have been too much.
It's very large as well.
It is very large because it was painted for the Spanish pavilion in an exhibition. So obviously it had to occupy quite a large space.
Going back to the war, do your families have any memories of the Civil War? Were they there in Spain?
Oh, certainly, certainly, yes. My uncle Marcos, I'm from San Sebastian in the Basque Country, and I have been to Guernica. My uncle Marcos was killed in the very early days of the war. There was fighting in the street, trying to stop the town falling into the hands of the military of Franco's side. All he had was a small handgun, and he was shot by the military with an explosive bullet, which was illegal, still is illegal. So he was killed. My grandfather, who was 70 when the war started, and had retired to his village in the centre of Spain. He was just leading a quiet life, farming a bit of land. He was taken out at night and shot and buried under some trees, where he still is. His death was never registered. I've been to the council house in the village, and his death was never registered, and that happened to lots of other people. Now, some relatives of people who are buried in the countryside or by roadsides, unearthing them and taking them to the cemetery. But that has only been possible in the last few years, when the Spanish government has given some help to the relatives, because you can imagine that if your relative happens to be buried in the land of a local council that happens to be right-wing, they wouldn't be very keen for you to go and dig up your grandfather or whoever and put him in the cemetery. So that was extremely difficult for the families, but in the last few years it has been possible. Some people are against it. They think we should forget the war. But for the people whose relatives were killed illegally and buried in unmarked graves, is for many of them, is very important to have a proper grave.
So the wounds have healed, finally?
They have, in a way, but we know, it's funny, because when you meet another Spaniard, you sort of know if their family was Republican or Francoist. There are plenty of young people now who haven't even heard of Franco, who have no interest in history at all, the way there are here. For people of my age, I wasn't alive at the time of the Civil War, but of course we've suffered the consequences in a way, because for a family who was on the Republican side, very often it meant losing your job, or perhaps, for example, one of my uncles, who was a station master in an important station, was demoted and sent to an end-of-the-line tiny little station. The school teacher in that village where my uncle ended up had also been in a good post in a big city school. She was sent to a small village school to do penance for having been a Republican. There were lots of people like that who suffered a lot. A couple of my uncles were in prison. They had been just fighting in the Republican army, so they had to spend some time in prison after the war. It meant that their families had no financial support. And, of course, prison was pretty horrible, bad for your health and demoralizing. I think people suffered enormously because a lot of their family members had to go into exile. For example, one of my uncles had to go into exile. He left Spain from Valencia at the last minute, at the end of the war. He went to France. The Spanish refugees were put in appalling concentration camps in France. The French didn't like the Spanish refugees, and there were so many of them. That was the problem. There is a notorious concentration camp in France called Argelès-sur-Mer. That was a beach All right, when people arrived, it was, the weather was okay, but they were just on the sand. There were no buildings, no toilet facilities, no food, nothing at all. And people were there through the winter. I've read accounts of people's experience in these refugee camps. It was really appalling, and it was impossible to get out unless you had a guarantor in France or you had money. Or for most people, it was just impossible to get out. My uncle was lucky in that he managed to get out and go to South America, but a lot of people just were stuck in France. And then, of course, the Second World War started. And you can imagine how much the Germans loved the Spanish refugees. Some of the Spanish refugees joined the resistance. But it was a really horrendous experience for the families of those who had to go abroad. Families just were split apart and complicated by the fact that in many families, as it was in mine, there were some family members on one side and some family members on the other side. Really, once the war ended, the Republican family members who were left in Spain, they were demoralized, they'd been defeated, they were repressed, they couldn't speak up. What's very striking is that many children in Republican families never heard their parents talk about the war, because of course our parents were afraid that if we said something at school, we would get into trouble. I was never told anything about the war at all. I didn't even hear about the way my grandfather was killed until much later. People had a really hard time, and also the 1940s in Spain, where the economy was in tatters. There was no food. There was a sort of rationing, but it wasn't like the British rationing where you got good quality food and people were healthy. And the Spanish rationing was rubbish food, really bad quality food and very small amounts. So you had to buy food in the black market. Pretty awful.
Thank you.
That was Palmira Sullivan talking to Anthea Page about Picasso's famous painting of Guernica and some of the events that occurred during the Spanish Civil War and the aftermath.
Time now for Chapter 8 of Treasure Island, written by Robert Louis Stevenson and read by the actor Malcolm Grieve. Treasure Island, for the uninitiated, is an adventure story. It's a narration of a tale of pirates and buried gold. It was first published in May 1883. It was originally serialised by the children's magazine Young Folks under the title Treasure Island or The Making of the Hispaniola and was published under the pseudonym Captain George North. This week, Jim Hawkins is in Bristol and meets Long John Silver at the Spyglass Inn.
Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 2, The Sea Cook. Chapter 8, At the Sign of the Spyglass. When I had done breakfasting, the squire gave me a note addressed to John Silver at the Sign of the Spyglass. He told me I should easily find the place by following the line of the docks and keeping a bright lookout for a little tavern with a large brass telescope for a sign. I set off, overjoyed at this opportunity to see some more of the ships and seamen, and picked my way among a great crowd of people and carts and bales, for the dock was now at its busiest, until I found the tavern in question. It was a bright enough little place of entertainment. The sign was newly painted, the windows had neat red curtains, the floor was cleanly sanded. There was a street on either side and an open door on both, which made the large low room pretty clear to see in spite of clouds of tobacco smoke. The customers were mostly seafaring men, and they talked so loudly that I hung at the door, almost afraid to enter. As I was waiting, a man came out of a side room, and at a glance I was sure he must be Long John. His left leg was cut off close by the hip, and under the left shoulder he carried a crutch, which he managed with wonderful dexterity, hopping about on it like a bird. He was very tall and strong, with a face as big as a ham, plain and pale, but intelligent and smiling. Indeed, he seemed in the most cheerful spirits, whistling as he moved about among the tables, with a merry word or a slap on the shoulder for the more favoured of his guests. Now, to tell you the truth, from the very first mention of Long John in Squire Trelawney's letter, I had taken a fear in my mind that he might prove to be the very one-legged sailor whom I had watched for so long at the old Benbow. But one look at the man before me was enough. I had seen the captain and Black Dog and the blind man Pew, and I thought I knew what a buccaneer was like. A very different creature, according to me, from this clean and pleasant-tempered landlord. I plucked up courage at once, crossed the threshold, and walked right up to the man where he stood, propped on his crutch, talking to a customer. "Mr. Silver, sir?" I asked, holding out the note.
"Yes, my lad," said he. "Such is my name, to be sure. And who may you be?"
And then, as he saw the squire's letter, he seemed to give me something almost like a start. "Oh!" said he, quite loud and offering his hand.
"I see. You're our new cabin boy. Pleased I am to see you."
And he took my hand in his large, firm grasp. Just then one of the customers at the far side rose suddenly and made for the door. It was close by him, and he was out on the street in a moment, but his hurry had attracted my notice, and I recognised him at a glance. It was the tallow-faced man, wanting two fingers, who had come first to the Admiral Benbow.
"Oh," I cried, "stop him, it's Black Dog."
"I don't care two coppers who he is," cried Silver, "but he hasn't paid his score. Harry, Run and catch him!
One of the others who was nearest the door leaped up and started in pursuit.
If he were Admiral Hawke, he shall pay his score,
cried Silver. And then, relinquishing my hand,
who did you say he was?
He asked.
Black what?
Dog, sir, said I. Has Mr. Trelawney not told you of the buccaneers? He was one of them.
So, cried Silver. In my house. Ben, run and help Harry. One of those swabs, was he? Was that you drinking with him, Morgan? Step up here.
The man whom he called Morgan, an old grey-haired, mahogany-faced sailor, came forward pretty sheepishly, rolling his quid.
Now, Morgan, said Long John very sternly, you never clapped your eyes on that black dog before, did you?
Not I, sir,
said Morgan with a salute.
You didn't know his name, did you?
No, sir.
By the powers, Tom Morgan, it's as good for you,
exclaimed the landlord.
If you had been mixed up with the like of that, you would never have put another foot in my house. You may lay to that. And what was he saying to you?
I don't rightly know, sir,
answered Morgan.
Do you call that a head on your shoulders, or a blessed dead-eye?
Cried Long John.
Don't rightly know, don't you? Perhaps you don't happen to rightly know who you were speaking to, perhaps. Come now, what was he jawing? Voyages? Captains? Ships? Pipe up! What was it?
We was a-talking of keel-hauling,
answered Morgan.
Keel-hauling, was you? And a mighty suitable thing, too, and you may lay to that. Get back to your place for a lubber, Tom.
And then, as Morgan rolled back to his seat, Silver added to me in a confidential whisper that was very flattering, as I thought. He's quite an honest man, Tom Morgan, only stupid.
And now, he ran on again aloud, let's see, black dog. No, I don't know the name. Not I. Yet, I kind of think I've... Yes, I've seen the swab. He used to come here with a blind beggar, he used.
That he did, you may be sure, said I. I knew that blind man too. His name was Pew.
It was,
cried Silver, now quite excited.
Pew, that were his name for certain. Ah, he looked a shark, he did. If we'd run down this black dog now, there'll be news for Captain Trelawney. Ben's a good runner. Few seamen run better than Ben. He should run him down hand over hand by the powers. He talked of keel-hauling, did he? I'll keel-haul him.
All the time he was jerking out these phrases, he was stumping up and down the tavern on his crutch, slapping tables with his hand and giving such a show of excitement as would have convinced an Old Bailey judge or a Bow Street runner. And my suspicions had been thoroughly reawakened on finding Black Dog at the Spyglass, and I watched the cook narrowly, but he was too deep and too ready and too clever for me. And by the time the two men had come back out of breath and confessed that they had lost the track in a crowd and been scolded like thieves, I would have gone bail for the innocence of Long John Silver.
See here now, Hawkins, said he. Here's a blessed hard thing on a man like me now, ain't it? There's Captain Trelawney. What's he to think? Here I have this confounded son of a Dutchman sitting in my own house, drinking of my own rum. Here you comes and tells me of it plain. And here, I let him give us all a slip before my blessed deadlights. Now, Hawkins, you do me justice to the cap'n. You're a lad, you are, but you're as smart as paint. I see that when you first came in. Now, here it is. What could I do with this old timber I hobble on? When I was an AB master mariner, I'd have come up alongside of him hand in hand and broached him to in a brace of old shakes, I would. But now... And then all of a sudden he stopped and his jaw dropped as though he had remembered something. The score, he burst out. 3 goes of rum. Why, shiver my timbers if I hadn't forgotten my score.
And falling on a bench, He laughed until the tears ran down his cheeks. I could not help joining in, and we laughed together, peal after peal, until the tavern rang again.
"Why, what a precious old sea-calf I am,"
he said at last, wiping his cheeks.
"You and me should get on well, Hawkins, for I'll take my Davy, I should be rated ship's boy. But come now, stand by to go about. This won't do. Duty is duty, messmates. I'll put on my old cocked hat and step along of you to Captain Trelawney and report this here affair. For mind you, it's serious, young Hawkins, and neither you nor me's come out of it with what I should make so bold as to call credit."
"Nor you neither," says you.
"Not smart. None of the pair of us smart. Dash my buttons, that was a good one about my score."
And he began to laugh again, and that so heartily, that though I did not see the joke as he did, I was again obliged to join him in his mirth. In our little walk along the quays, he made himself the most interesting companion, telling me about the different ships that we passed by, their rig, tonnage and nationality, explaining the work that was going forward, how one was discharging, another taking in cargo, and a third making ready for sea, and every now and then telling me some little anecdote of ships or seamen, or repeating a nautical phrase till I'd learned it perfectly. I began to see that here was one of the best of possible shipmates. When we got to the inn, the squire and Dr. Livesey were seated together, finishing a quart of ale with a toast in it, before they should go aboard the schooner on a visit of inspection. Long John told the story from first to last, with a great deal of spirit and the most perfect truth. "That was how it were now, weren't it, Hawkins?" he would say now and again, and I could always bear him entirely out. The two gentlemen regretted that Black Dog had got away, but we all agreed that there was nothing to be done, and after he had been complimented, Long John took up his crutch and departed. "All hands aboard by 4 this afternoon," shouted the squire after him.
"Aye, aye, sir,"
cried the cook in the passage.
"Well, squire," said Dr. Livesey, "I don't put much faith in your discoveries as a general thing, but I will say this. John Silver suits me."
"The man's a perfect trump,"
declared the squire.
"And now," added the doctor, "Jim may come on board with us, may he not?"
"To be sure he may," said the squire. "Take your hat, Hawkins, and we'll see the ship."
Well, that was Chapter 8 of Treasure Island, written by Robert Louis Stevenson. Thank you very much to Malcolm Grieve. The Spyglass Inn was so called because there was a spy hole in the wall, so the locals could be forewarned about the presence of press gangs in the area.
Rosemary Dunn, a poet from Southville, is here in the studio to read one of her poems. Hello, Rosemary.
Hi there.
What's the subject for your poem this week?
Okay, this poem is about Brian Cox, and I wrote it in a moment of panic when I found out I was booked to do an hour's comedy slot at a festival at Hay on Wye called How the Light Gets In, and a festival of philosophy and music and comedy. I'm a bit of a fan of Brian Cox, and it turned out he was on the programme. So I thought, I'll do a poem, but I've got an hour to fill. I'll get a ukulele as well. I can't play the ukulele, as you'll hear when the poem comes on. And I only managed to shorten my time to get a group lesson. So I think that's probably about 10 minutes worth of ukulele. But that's half of the joke. So it's a kind of poem / song / comedy mashup or mishmash up.
Fantastic. So can you introduce your poem before you start it?
Yes. It's a poem about Brian Cox called Brian Cox. Brian Cox, oh Brian Cox, his hair's a mank mop of brown locks, his
teeth are whiter than Nike socks. He wanders blithely over rocks. He strikes a pose on mountain tops. He's been a guest star on Never Mind the Buzzcocks. He's an urbane spaceman, the thinking gal's crumpet. He plays the keyboard, doesn't blow his own trumpet. On Top of the Pops in a band called D-Ream, their famous tune became the Labour Party theme. He talks of Mars and the belt of Orion. He's not an Aussie, though his name is Brian. He's the atheist Jesus who can turn you onto space with his heavenly body and his nice smiley face. Women line up to give him a grope. They've heard he's got a big telescope. Oh, Brian Cox. Better in tight jeans than gingham frocks. His face is smooth, not blemish my spots. I can't concentrate when he's in shot. Cos Brian is a scientist who's got the lot. Trippy hippie than emo or goth. He's better looking than Noel Fielding from Never Mind the Buzzcocks. He knows all about the Hadron Collider. He's got a big smile that couldn't be wider, cause he loves his job with CERN in Geneva. Then I saw his face, now I'm a believer. He's a lecturer and a keynote speaker. Makes weak-kneed women's knees go weaker. Professor Brian, he works at Manchester Uni. He looks quite slim, but you wouldn't call him puny. Brian's Mr. Universe with brain, not brawn. Can't query his theories. They're as worthy as corn. Oh, Brian Cox, oh, Brian Cox. His space CV dwarfs Mr. Spock's. He understands time, ticks and tocks. I wrote this poem on Google Docs, I did. He explains dark matter's building blocks. All the ladies think he's a fox. And he's been a guest star on Big Finale coming up. Never Mind the Buzzcocks.
Thank you, Rosemary, for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me, and I can only apologise.
Thank you. Tim Burrows is here in the studio with a song. What have you got for us this week, Tim?
It's a song called When Words Cannot Sum at the Present. It's a sort of poetic song. It's like some of the work I've been doing, which is kind of between song and poetry.
Can you tell us a little bit more about how the song originated or the story?
Well, I like Pablo Neruda, who's a great Chilean poet, and he uses a lot of imagery in his work, and I was trying to kind of work that into the song.
Great.
Present. The past lies dead on the floor. The future, she cries, the wailing of tears. Today's just a pile of fears. Throw away your tongue, block up your ears, let your lips seal the opening door. Cause love, she rides a stallion untamed, who's bolted, not tied anymore. When And sighs cannot fill up the silence, when tears cannot mist your sight, when thoughts cannot capture the moment, nor wine take you through the night. Throw away your tongue, block up your ears, let your lips seal the opening door. Cause love, she rides a stallion untamed, who's bolded, not tied anymore. Sum up the present, and the past lies dead on the floor. The future, she cries with a wailing of tears. Today's just a pile of fears. Throw away your tongue, block up your ears, let your lips seal the opening door. Cause love, she rides a stallion untamed, who's bolded, not tied anymore. Cause love, she rides a stallion untamed, who's bolded, not tied anymore.
Thanks once again, as ever, to Tim Burrows, a Song of the Week.
That's all from Dialect this week. The studio guest was Graham Luff, and he will be returning next week. Features were by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling, and Malcolm Grieve read Chapter 8 of Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. The song was by Tim Burrows, and we had a poem from Rosemary Dunn. Engineer was Michael Noyce. The presenters were myself, John Peters Coleman.
And me, Sophia Costa.
And the producer was Anthea Page. And we're going to play out with a recording by Ernest Luff now, and this was his personal favourite, Hear Ye Israel.